This is the Dairy Download, brought to you by EverAg Insights and the International Dairy Foods Association, where we offer extra sharp market and policy insights on dairy. I'm your host, Phil Plord. Kathleen Wolfley is still on assignment, but we have my talented colleague, Katie Burgess, back for another episode. Hey, Katie.
Hey, Phil.
On today's episode, we are focusing on weight loss drugs and food demand, a topic I personally find fascinating. We have two guests following the story closely, but we'll get to that in a minute. First, here's a rundown on markets as of Monday, March 11th. CME spot block cheddar cheese, $1.44 per pound. Just another dip in that marketplace, down 6% versus last week. Barrels dragged down as well, $1.46 a pound, down 11%. CME butter remains the star of the show, $2.80 per pound, unchanged on the week. And then non-fat dry milk, $1.17, down 3%. Katie, what's the most important thing right now?
Well, Phil, I think you alluded to it in your price rundown, but to me, the cheese market remains the top story out there. The market's struggling, trying to balance supply and demand. It seemed like in late February, we were finally going somewhere up into the low 160s, but here we are, back to the low 140s again. So as a quick update, I mean, USDA reported we made a little less cheese in January. I think that's less cheap spot milk around. But when we talk to folks, there's still plenty of cheese out there. And with more capacity coming online in the next 12 to 18 months, we're just going to continue to have more. So I know you like to follow the demand trends pretty closely. And we're going to need something to pick up in the demand space if we're going to find a home for all this cheese and get that market to move out of the recent lows.
Yeah, the January domestic demand number was not good. It was down more than 2%. And I think that, you know, we can get the export game. January exports were okay. They were up a little bit over year prior levels. But here's the challenge. We can only get in the export game, it seems like, when we're cheaper than 150. And so we're back in this rhythm of, you know, we get below 150, we book some exports. Within 6 weeks, we shorten up supply a little bit because we're shipping it out overseas. Our price goes up. We get out of the export game. Then we have to kind of crash, you know, to get those exports back. And that's been the rhythm this market's been in for, I don't know, at least 6 months and probably longer.
And it feels like for the dairy producers I talk to, you know, it's just not a price that they can sustain at for a long time, even with low feed costs. So I know the dairy farmers out there are definitely hoping for a little bit of a rally, hopefully sooner rather than later.
The year-end dip in cheese prices and the failure to launch here early in 2024 has been a real kick to the shins. And we hear stories of some really poor milk checks out there and definitely rising angst for producers in class three lands.
No, that's definitely true. I don't know. How about you? What's your most important thing right now?
Here we're just going to pile onto the misery, I guess, or the bearish case. I think the most important thing right now is European milk production. And I know we've talked, you know, it's been the most important thing on several episodes over the past, whatever, 18 to 24 months. It's always important. But we've noticed over the past few weeks that milk production in Germany and France has been perking up. In fact, a couple of weeks ago, when you combine them, they were up 0.3% over year prior levels. Now, that's not, you know, a massive tidal wave of milk, but we were running 2% below year prior levels in the fourth quarter. And so, you know, we're just not in a place where the world is ready for more European milk production. And if those numbers creep higher, which it's a toss up on whether they will or not, we've done all the, you know, we've are struggling enough already on prices. You know, more European milk won't help that situation if that's the way we're going.
No, it all links back to demand. And I think on the global front, it's still soft. And I guess with that, I'll maybe lead into my stat of the week, which does have to do with global demand. My number for this week was 39%. Tried to find something a little optimistic out there in the demand data, but 39%, that's how much January cheese exports to Mexico increased compared to a year ago. So the January trade data was pretty solid, which I think makes us think more about the cheese supply-demand balance. But if we outline the numbers, Mexico accounted for about a third of the cheese exports from the U.S. during January, but accounted for nearly all of the growth we saw in sales. Again, just, you know, good to see some positive demand out there from at least one of our key trading partners, even though the rest of the spots demand is definitely touch and go.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at cheese, you know, Mexico took in 55 million more pounds from the U.S. in 23 versus 22, 20%. And the January number is 8 million pounds, and that was up close to 40% year over year. And so If you think the story is rough now for the bulls, if Mexico somehow goes south, you know, we are in a world of hurt, you know, price-wise. There's no evidence that's going to happen. I think Mexico's on solid footing. The peso's bounced back. There's a lot of reshoring going on. The Mexican economy looks pretty good. But in the world where cheese exports to the rest of the world are not performing very well, we kind of need that Mexican business to keep afloat.
For sure.
My stat of the week is fresh off the presses this morning, and it concerns headline inflation. 3.2% overall inflation in the U.S. in February of 24 versus February of 23. Just a little hotter than the consensus, which was at 3.1% year-over-year growth. And so, but I think that it's back to, you know, we have these constant reminders that inflation is not over and done with. We are seeing slower growth, but we're not under the Fed's 2% target. From a food perspective, though, we did, you know, prices are up 2.2% for food. That's the best we've seen in a while. So that's calming down, but we're still stacking that on top of 2 years of pretty heavy inflation. So we're still, you know, up 20%-ish on a three-year basis. So I just think that, you know, the inflation story is still, you know, it's less excitable month to month. We're not seeing big flashy numbers, but it hasn't gone away. And that, you know, it creates drama in the interest rate conversation, but it also creates tension around consumer spending and, you know, where the economy is going. And I think we're skating by, but it's a very tenuous situation.
No, for sure. I know from, you know, just here in my own family, it's still expensive to go out to eat. And sometimes when you get the bill, you're like, I'm going to cook at home for a few days. So it definitely matters to folks out there.
We don't do much fast food here, but we were on the road the other day and two of us went through the drive-thru, you know, pretty basic chicken sandwich, medium fries and drink, you know, $24.50. And it seemed like that was maybe a $15 max kind of expenditure not so long ago. What is your fearless prediction?
All right. So next week, we get the latest milk production data. It'll come out on Wednesday, March 20th. USDA will give us the February data. Here at EverEgg, our model is projecting that output is going to decline by 1.2% in February. That would be even a little steeper decline than last month. But on our model, I'm going to take the over. I don't think it was down quite that much. We still expect a negative number. And honestly, we're forecasting negative numbers for quite a few months forward yet. But I don't think it'll be down quite as much as our model projects at 1.2%.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's some places that just seem like they're in permanent deficit or sort of all of a sudden chronic deficit. But the Midwest, I think, is probably sneaky good on good weather. And the Northeast is, you know, the financials there are a little better and the weather hasn't been bad, right?
Yeah, exactly. We'll see how it goes. I mean, the past few months, we have been surprised to the downside, so could be wrong, but we'll see on Wednesday where the numbers land. How about you, Phil? What's your bold prediction this week?
You know, I'm going to stick with this inflation data. I don't think that we are going to see headline inflation, CPI for all products, below 3% for the next, I don't know, I'll go 6 months on that. I just don't think we're going to see a two handle here. You know, the big retreat can be if energy prices go way lower. That's where we get a drag on the numbers. But I just don't see how that headline number gets to be below 3% over the next 3 to 6 months.
Economists always say that that last percentage point to get to target is going to be the hardest one. So
it's stubborn.
Feels like that could be true. All right, Phil, let's get to our first guest.
We are excited to welcome Darren Seifer to the show. Darren is an industry advisor for consumer goods and food service with Circana, where he provides data-driven insights to food companies based on consumption attitudes and behaviors. Darren, welcome back to the Dairy Download.
Yeah, thanks for having me back, Phil.
So the conversation today is about GLP-1 medications kind of creeping out of the shadows here in recent months. Certainly, advertising for products like Ozempic has become almost ubiquitous if you're watching sports on television anyway. What are you seeing in the data that you track that may or may not be tied to the increasing use of GLP-1 drugs?
Yeah. No, it's a really fascinating topic right now. You know, when we look at how many people are on this, we estimate that about 5% of adults are currently using a GLP-1 drug. Now, keep in mind, you know, we're talking about for the purpose of weight loss, and which is kind of the off-label use of that. And it seems like it's everywhere. It seems like it's huge. I mean, every time you turn on an award show, I think of the Grammys that a few weeks ago, Trevor Noah made a joke about people in the audience all being on Ozempic or something like that. And I kind of remember Jimmy Kimmel doing that at another recent show too. But think about who that audience is. They are the one percenters. They are the ones who have the money to buy it if their insurance doesn't cover it. And so it feels like it's one of those things that's catching a lot of headlines right now, but less than 5% of people are actually on it for the purpose of weight loss. So it's still something that we're watching, we're monitoring it as it continues to grow. And you know, when you consider the fact that not everyone is on this drug for the purpose of weight loss, that takes it down to much less than 5% as well. But what I can say is that when we ask consumers about what their wellness goals are, users of these drugs tend to skew a little bit more towards managing a health condition, which is probably diabetes in this case, more so than losing weight. So again, when you're trying to figure out what's the real purpose that people are using this drug for, it still seems to be more about managing the condition than weight loss. But you know, I'm not downplaying the weight loss side of it because it's certainly there. We've yet to see things like the basket sizes when they go to the store getting smaller, or that they're going to the store less often, you know, because we have to consider the fact that not everyone in the household is on that drug, right? So there's still plenty of needs that need to be met by other members of the home. So we're still watching it. It's still it's somewhat of a small behavior. We get that it's growing. So we're going to watch and see how that manifests.
But certainly, I mean, we've heard from major retailers on the topic, and especially those with pharmacies have been kind of, you know, spotlighting some trends they're seeing in their own stores. The food companies are certainly sitting up a little straighter in their chairs, especially the snack food companies. So, I mean, it's, you know, somewhere in that zone of, we know it's there, it's probably worth paying attention to, but we still don't really have a good feel for the actual data. That's kind of what you're saying, right?
Yeah, absolutely right. You know, there's probably some decent changes that are happening with the people who are actually on it in terms of how much that translates into the total population, given how small this group of people are. We haven't seen the needle move just yet, but hey, if this continues to expand and more consumers are opting for it, then we might start to see some shifts at the total level.
In terms of Circana's work with consumers, have you been surveying consumers, looking at their behavior? What have you learned so far, anyway, from the consumer side of things?
So, what we've been able to determine is, as of right now, those consumers who are on these drugs, they tell us that they are more likely to avoid things like carbohydrates, alcohol, calories, even. At least that's the desire. You know, we're still trying to monitor it. We're still trying to build up the sample so we could get a good enough read on these things. But directionally, it looks like they are trying to avoid some of those things that, quote unquote, put on weight versus things like getting more protein in their diets. They're looking for things that provide them with more energy. So it looks as though they're trying to achieve a bit more of a healthful diet. Now, of course, not everyone stays on these drugs for the long term. So the question is, what happens when they come off of these drugs? Do they go back? Do they revert to their behaviors? So we're still trying to figure that out right now. But it does seem as though consumers on these drugs are trying to be a bit more healthful with their choices.
And we've seen some coverage, I believe it was in the Wall Street Journal in the past several weeks. They had an article about food companies starting to think about, I'll call them ride-along products. You mentioned protein. We talk about dairy on the show. I mean, if I recall correctly, protein shakes was something that emerged as part of the conversation around, we'll call them Ozempic-friendly, Ozempic diet-adjacent products. Have you seen anything along those lines in your work?
Well, again, those are some of the properties that these consumers are seeking. I mean, and it's not something that's completely unique to them. About 40% of adults say that they want more protein in their diets as it is. And so now we have a group of consumers that are kind of being a little bit more focused on that as well. And so it is one of those things that marketers should pay attention to, things that help them stay fuller, stay longer. If we know that they're not going to be eating as much, then we need to make sure that they're getting foods and beverages that that meet their needs at the same time. So there's directional evidence of that.
How will we know, Darren, if ever, that we're at some sort of tipping point on this GLP-1 journey? Is there something that in the Circana data you're looking at, either on the restaurant side or in the retail side of things, that you'll say, aha, is it just fewer tons over the scanner? What would be the aha moment?
I think it would be a mixture of points. You know, there are certainly, we could look at what consumers are buying, if they're on it or not. We could take a look at the caloric intake of consumers who are on these drugs to see if there's actually a decrease in that. You know, one of the interesting things is that we have noticed there are volume declines over the last couple of years at retail. And people are saying, well, people aren't eating as much, but that's actually not the case. People are eating the same amount, right? It's just they're having the same number of meals. They're just kind of finding ways to spend less on it. They're not stuffing their pantries as deeply. So we need to look at a few different ways to say, okay, we've hit that tipping point. And it's a mixture of what are people buying, what are they eating, and how much are they eating. And when we kind of put those three points together, we could get a sense of, okay, we've hit that tipping point. I don't think we're there yet, though.
To your point, too, the other thing to watch is if you're a Grammy Award-winning artist, you can probably afford, you know, the shot, if you will, today. But there's also down the road, you know, what are we going to see in pill form? What are we going to see in terms of affordability? I mean, are you also contemplating what the world looks like as the drug evolves?
That would be really interesting, because one of the things that I think, whether these drugs are here to stay or they kind of fizzle, is that consumers are going to always look for ways that they could either lose weight or get healthier without really having to do much to change in their diets, or just easy ways to get the job done. And so if there's going to be something else that comes down the line, like you just said, if it comes in pill format, if it becomes more accessible to more consumers, that might start getting more people involved with it. And, you know, then, like we just said, we might see some kind of a tipping point. But you know, right now, it's still really about the 1%ers or people who have the disposable income to afford this off-label.
We wonder about what happens when people stop using the drug. You know, do their behaviors change? What has Circana learned about that?
What I can tell you about that is that we look every month to see, okay, how many people are taking this drug? And what was interesting is it seemed as that in the last month of the year, December, that there was a little bit of a pullback on the number of people on it. So, you know, holidays come around, and does that mean that, you know, we're going to forego some of these healthful needs in favor of some of these more indulgent wants that we have during that time of year? It's tough to tell just yet what happens to people when they come off of it. Are they reverting back to their old behaviors, or are they saying, hey, I want to keep this weight loss that I spent so much money on? We don't really quite know that yet, but it directionally, it does seem that when we are confronted with times of the year when we tend to be more indulgent, there is a little bit of a pullback on doing this.
Beyond Ozempic, Darren, interesting economic times. We have student loan repayments. We have SNAP benefit reductions. We have massive credit card debt piling up. But we have a strong labor environment, cheap gas. I mean, it's a very rich potpourri of economic indicators out there. What are you seeing just generally of where the consumer is right now in terms of spending week to week on food in restaurants and at grocery stores? Do you see headwinds? Do you see blue skies ahead? Do you have a view on that?
In terms of consumer spend on food, the average grocery price today is about 30% higher than it was in 2019. Now, we keep seeing indicators of inflation coming down. You see single digits versus last year. But when you think about just 4 short years ago, prices were 30% lower. That's a tough pill to swallow for consumers. And like you just said, SNAP benefits have been cut, student loans are coming back to being paid. So there's a lot that are squeezing consumers' wallets right now. And because it's food and beverage, we're not going to stop buying these products, but we're going to start making some choices. We're going to start saying, okay, do I need to buy this impulse item because I'm spending so much more on all the, these other things that I actually do need? We have seen consumers pull back on general merchandise because the priority is about food, right? And so once they settle up what they're going to do with their foods and beverages, they're seeing that there's a whole lot less money left over to spend on clothing, on technology, you know, our new phones. So we've definitely seen consumers are making more choices about how they spend their money.
We've seen a lot of press about food companies paying attention to this trend. How do you think they could be thinking about adapting to the GLP-1 era or whatever you want to call it? I mean, do you see steps that food companies should be taking to learn more, do more, be prepared?
Yeah, well first off, this is still an emerging trend. And so what we need to do is continue to monitor this. Continue to monitor this before we build a plan and start spending money against it. You know, we're just not exactly sure which direction this is going to take. So I would hate to tell a marketer to build this very expensive plan against it and then see that the trend shifts in a different direction. So let's continue to watch this. But if this continues to build and we see more and more consumers are getting involved with this and having those similar needs, I think there are ways that we could maybe address those needs. Well, number one, if we know that they're going to be eating less, thinking about some smaller portions for these consumers, just so that we have products that are right there for what they're looking for. Or we could have larger sizes that have lots of little portions preset within the product so that they kind of a way to build some loyalty with these consumers by continuously having them go to that product. And I think if the nutrients are there that they're looking for things like protein, you know, make sure that we're plugging up those properties of these products, or if there are ways that we could add some of those nutrients in them. And I think particularly for dairy items, you know, dairy has a lot of these properties that consumers in general are looking for, but also consumers on these drugs are also looking for. So the high levels of protein, and in many ways that a lot of these products are low in carbohydrates. So there are things that are natural to a lot of dairy products that some of these consumers are also looking for. So it's a great way to kind of connect with that. But again, I think the first step is to just see where this trend is going first.
Darren, we so appreciate you coming back to the Dairy Download to share some of your wisdom. Thank you for being here.
Great. Thanks for having me back.
Next, we have a conversation with an analyst studying consumer trends very closely. We are excited to welcome Dan Frommer to the show. Dan is the founder and editor-in-chief at The New Consumer, an online publication that covers the intersection of technology and consumer brands. He focuses on how new technology impacts consumer spending habits. Dan, welcome to the Dairy Download.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm going to tell you, I'm going to nerd out here today, Dan, because I am really fascinated by the Ozempic topic, a lot of the media coverage, the potential impact on food consumption, frankly, in the United States is something that we consider as dairy market analysts or whatever. So let's get right at it. GLP-1 weight loss drugs, Ozempic, Wegovy, Mounjaro, they've been taking the world by storm. Last year, your organization, The New Consumer, released a report with research on this trend. Tell us how you got interested and tell us what your research focused on.
Well, thanks again for having me. I really appreciate it. And yes, I'm Dan Frommer. I am a longtime business and technology journalist. About 5 years ago, I started this new thing called The New Consumer. And it's mostly a digital publication read by entrepreneurs, executives, and investors at the kind of intersection of CPG and tech, a lot of food executives and founders. And so we're all very interested in this topic, not only because of the profound effects it might have on the health of Americans, which could be really beneficial, but also, you know, the second and third degree effects. Well, what are people going to be eating more of? What are they going to be eating less of? What changes after that, et cetera? So this is part of a research series called Consumer Trends that I put out two or three times a year with a venture capital firm in New York called Coefficient Capital. Everything I'm about to talk about is available for you to read and download and share for free at my website, newconsumer.com/trends, or just go to newconsumer.com and look in the nav bar and click trends, and it's all there. And we are, the way that we do this is we tend to focus on 5 or 6 topics per report. And we've been very personally interested and obviously very professionally interested in these GLP-1 drugs for quite some time. And last year, we put out two reports focusing on them. One of them was our research around how people thought about them, what their level of interest was. And then in this latest report in December, we actually polled almost 400 of them as part of our research. So we typically triangulate data from a lot of different sources. At the highest level, Americans are not well. There's a huge obesity crisis in America. It is something like 40% of American adults are considered obese. It leads to shorter lives. It leads to higher incidence of heart disease and other you know, fatal diseases. So this is something that could not only help people lose weight for, you know, whatever, cosmetic or social reasons, but also really prolong their lives and save lives. So that's why we think this is a really fascinating drug from a public health perspective.
And they work, right? I mean, that's the other thing is they work.
Yeah.
I mean, at least at a high level, that's what we're seeing, right?
It is. Yeah. It's really interesting. And the way these drugs work, just in case anyone is not familiar, is they basically make you feel full or less hungry. So you consume fewer calories, quite a bit fewer calories, 20 to 30%, I believe. And the idea is that you will lose weight pretty quickly, and pretty substantially while you're on these drugs. And that's one of the asterisks here is you have to kind of stay on these drugs for them to work over the long time. But yeah, they do work. You may ask people some very granular questions like what they're eating more or less of, what they're doing more or less of. Straight up, we ask them, do you feel like a different person since you started taking these drugs? And 86% of people on these drugs say they feel like a different person, mostly in a good way, some in a bad way, but fascinating. Also, people dress differently. They act differently. They've been living different lives. So it's very interesting the way that these drugs not only can improve your health, but they can also make you feel like a different person, which I find very interesting.
So let me share what the aha moment for me as I've wandered through some of the research is. Walmart, at some point in the last 6 to 8 months, Walmart said something along the lines of, hey, we've noticed that the people that are buying Ozempic and these other GLP-1 drugs at our pharmacies are spending less money on the other side of the store, at the other side of the supercenter. They are putting less food across the scanner. And like, well, you know, all right, that's pretty concrete evidence of material change in behavior or whatever, with potential consequences for the food industry. I mean, what other, have you seen other anecdotes along those lines? Or, I mean, what's the most compelling statistic or data point you've seen?
What I'll say around all of this, though, is that it's still pretty early. We don't know really how people are going to be on these drugs, if they are for a very long time, how they will consume differently over the long run. One of the more interesting data points, and by the way, just as an example of that, there's actually no official stat of how many people are on these drugs, which is interesting to me. We guess that it's around 8 to 15 million Americans already, which is a lot, but it's not 10% of Americans. It's not 25% of Americans. So any early effects are based on a pretty small percentage of the population in a pretty short period of time. One of the more interesting data sources for this report is a company called Numerator. They do a lot of survey work. They also have a scanner panel, so they can actually see what people are purchasing more and less of, and then match that with some of their survey data to see what GLP-1 users are actually buying less of. And certainly in their data, they saw that those folks who are on GLP-1 drugs are spending a little less money on grocery. They're spending less money on things like ice cream and snacks and frozen foods. And then other categories that were losing a lot were like beans and grains, the deli, and prepared foods. But other sections of the grocery store were less affected. Meal kits, less affected. Beverages, less affected. People are supposed to be eating more protein while they're taking these drugs because that's one of the effects is some lack of muscle mass. And in fact, in our research, people said they are consuming more protein than they were prior to being on the drugs. Fewer carbs, less snacking. But those are some of the behavioral changes that I think will take some time to pan out.
So, Dan, let's go back to why or how this trend came to be. It seemed like a lot of these started out as medications to treat diabetes and now morphed into more. Can you tell us about that transformation within the space?
Yeah, it started certainly at that, you know, and that is one of the more serious diseases that it is designed to treat. And I don't know the exact like schedule of history, but at some point folks realize, okay, well, if we can lose weight and manage diabetes, we can also lose weight and manage non-diabetes situations where people are simply overweight or profoundly overweight. And then at some point that they became prescribed for those purposes kind of off-label. And then certain versions of the drug then were later approved to be used for weight loss management outright, you know, with not kind of gray market status. And they're very, very interesting to people. A lot of Americans want to lose weight. We actually did one of my favorite survey questions we've ever done. We asked people, and part of our research is we do a survey of 3,000 Americans two or three times a year. So this is from one of our most recent surveys. We asked people straight up, would you rather feel 25% healthier or earn 25% more money? And across all income groups in America, people said, I would rather feel 25% healthier than earn 25% more money. 40% of Americans in our research are very interested in losing weight. And a lot of those people, about 30% of those who are aware of these weight loss drugs, are interested in using them. So the what started as kind of an off-label use case for them is now a very, very compelling use case from a societal interest point of view. They might be able to help with other things like addiction or something like that. We'll see. I'm not sure where that goes, but that's kind of the storyline. And if again, the official stats are kind of different than what people say they're using them for, but already a pretty substantial percentage of people using these drugs are using them for a weight loss point and not just diabetic management.
On that, do you know how long people tend to stay on the drugs once they're on them and what the long run view in is how this might impact Americans going forward?
The kind of unfortunate part of this is you really are supposed to stay on them for a long period of time. And if you're managing diabetes, you're probably on them for many, many years. And there are definitely people who are approaching this as, I'll use it for a little bit of time. I'll use it for 6 months. In our survey of people who were taking the medication, there was a pretty substantial difference between those who were taking it for weight loss and those who are using it for diabetes. That, you know, 2/3 of people using it for diabetes said they plan to use it regularly over the long term. Whereas if you look at those who are using it for weight loss, it's more of a 50-50 split. Some plan to use it over the long term. Some plan to go on and off. And then a very small percentage of people said, I'll just use it once and see what happens and then I'll stop. The other thing is that these drugs are very expensive or can be very expensive depending on your insurance coverage. So if you need these to manage your diabetes, you're probably paying a smaller copay. If you are just going out there and get this to lose weight, in some degree of official prescription, it can be up to $1,000 a month copay. So that obviously has, there's a smaller percentage of people who can afford that or who want to pay that. And therefore, those types of people are also probably going to use it for a shorter period of time, at least up front. Then there's the future where these drugs might be, the other thing is we didn't talk about yet is you have to give yourself an injection to use these drugs, not every day, but there's some level of discomfort with that.
Yeah. So, right. Ingestible pill form, maybe different routines, different cost. I mean, if you're just speculating here, Dan, I mean, I've guessed that we're probably close to maybe 1%, less than 1% use in the country, right? You maybe 0.5%. I don't know. It's not widespread to your point. How big could this be just as far as, just if you were just in a parlor game guessing?
There's a lot of interest. 30% of people who are aware of these drugs want to use them, even higher among people who want to lose weight. So, and another quarter of the population is interested in them. So we could be at a point where 50 to 100 million Americans are on these drugs, at least for some period of time. You know, that there's about 330 million Americans or something like that. So a pretty substantial percentage of the population. Again, we don't really know what the very long-term impacts of these are on people's health. We don't know what the kind of midterm interest is in people once they've experienced some side effects, or perhaps some people lose the weight that they need to lose. And then, I mean, the ideal case is that they can get off the drug and then use their, you know, whatever, you know, whatever they learn from it to stay under their target weight. It doesn't typically probably work that way. You probably need to use them over the long run or on and off to do that. And the drugs work. Nothing's magic, but they do work. And so if enough people discover those benefits and improve their health, which they say they want to do, and weight always comes up as the number one issue for people before things like sleep and other medical issues.
Even money,
yeah. And you know, you kind of have a mixed sense about this. Like, oh, is this really good for society if everyone has to take drugs to be at a healthy weight? And then, you know, we ask people about that too. Do you think that these drugs will have an overall positive or negative effect on society? We like to sometimes slice our data by age groups or generations. And this was one where there's a pretty interesting generational differences. Millennials were the ones that had the highest positive vote for that question. And then some other generations had a lower positive vote for that.
Is it just viewed as technology, really, right? I mean, is it just younger people are more willing to adopt technology kind of thing, you think?
I think that's some of it. I think, you know, people who grew up with internet and social media and kind of a more visceral sense of being a public persona, even among your friend groups and looking, you know, everyone's being pictured all the time. I think different generations have different points of view on what healthy is, how weight fits into their ideal selves and that sort of thing. But also millennials are kind of in the prime age category for this, in that they are in their kind of professional boom years. They have, many of them have the money for this, or at least more than younger people who are earlier in their careers. And perhaps, actually going back to that question, would you rather have 25% more money or be 25% healthier? The only group in age groups that chose the money was Gen Z, probably because they are younger and probably healthier just by default and could use a little more money. So there's so many different things affecting, I think, what people say in these types of things. But it is, you know, in our most recent research, there was a higher proportion of people saying there would be a positive impact on society from these medications than negative. And that was pretty telling, I think.
Well, Dan, that's fascinating stuff. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Dairy Download.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
That's a wrap for today's show. Thanks to Katie for filling in. As always, we want to thank our production team, Matt Herrick, Mariah McKenzie, Michael Gooden, and Andrew Jerome at IDFA, and the insights team over here at ever.ag. If you are interested in what Katie and I do for our day jobs, check us out at ever.ag. Remember, if you enjoy the show, hit the subscribe button and leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform.
Thanks for listening to the Dairy Download. And until next time, stay sharp.